So hello everyone, my name is Ariadna Moria-Vertier and I'll talk about stars that disappear without a trace and how we can use this in order to constrain their angular momentum. So this is work that I've been doing with my collaborators all around the globe. So first, let me tell you about the outline. I'll discuss a little bit about how two disappearing stars that we have, two examples. I'll give some explanations as how they are formed. Then I'll talk in more detail about one of the possible explanations, which is the direct collapse of a black hole. I'll talk about how we can evolve the black hole and how we can use the accretion disk feedback in order to constrain the angular momentum. And I'll talk about some simulations that I've been doing with low angular momentum flows onto black holes. And I'll use that in order to constrain the maximum angular momentum of disappearing stars and set limits on stellar rotation rates. So the first disappearing star I'll talk about is N6946VH1. This is a 2030 solar mass star found in a very dusty galaxy. What I'm showing right here is a plot of the brightness as a function of time. So here you can see the star is just fine, it's bright, 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 and then suddenly there's a weak optical outburst, and then it basically fades away and disappears. There's an increase in 5 magnitudes and we haven't seen it yet. And up until 2020, this star is still out of the radar, so we haven't seen it. The other disappearing star, it's called PHL293b. This one is a luminous blue variable, a very massive star, so it's around from 80 to 100 solar mass star. And it's been pulsating, it's a luminous blue variable. So what I'm showing here is the spectrum. So the flux is a function of wavelength. This is for H alpha and for H beta. And this is as a function of time. The dashed line represents spectra taken at 2009. And what I want you to notice is that it's this wing-like structure right here. So this is the signature from a luminous blue variable. And here you see this wing-like structure, but at some point at 2011, you suddenly don't see this wing-like structure. So the eruption from the luminous blue variable ended at 2011 and it hasn't erupted again yet. So this also disappeared without leaving a trace. We haven't seen any kind of bright transient after this. So again, this star is very, very massive. It's for 180 to 100 solar masses. So that's something to keep in mind. So one of the possible explanations in particular for N6946VH1 is, I mean, we have the clue that it's full of dust. So it could have been the case that it's obscured by a dusty shell from a companion. But that option has been ruled out because it is inconsistent with the late time evolution of the star. Another option is that it could have come from a stellar merger where the envelope of the star is ejected at very low velocities. And that naturally explains the dust. The problem is that if that were the case, we would have definitely seen a luminous transient even for a little bit of time, not this weak optical outburst. So that has also been discarded. Now for this very massive one, PHL293b, this one could be a pairing stability supernova. So for a pairing stability supernova, in that case, you need a very, very massive star. There's going to be electron-positron pairs forming in the core of the star. This takes away thermal energy or pressure from the star, which makes the gravity win, and the core is going to collapse a bit, reduce its size. This will increase its temperature, which is going to make more pairs, which of course is going to then again take away thermal energy, reduce its size, and it's a runaway process that ends up in this thermonuclear explosion that destroys the star and it leaves no remnant. But of course, this could not have been the case because an explosion of this size would have definitely left something and we would have definitely seen a transient. So even though it is in the pairing stability gap, that is discarded. Now, another very interesting option, and this could be, is that it's just the luminous blue variable is just quiescent right now. It will erupt again later, but right now it's just silenced. There's another possibility for both of them that I'll talk about, but I won't go into a lot of detail, which is a mild supernova. In this case, after
Ariana, to, mm-hmm? Sorry to interrupt. If I may ask, just to clarify on the previous slide, so the plot in the on the upper left. So so you meant that the star disappeared, but so the measurements on the sort of right part of the plot. So those are not upper limits. Those are actual measurements.
You mean these ones?
On the right.
On
like
the
after
right,
the outburst.
Yep. These ones.
Yes, these ones.
Yes, I think there are. I mean, they seem to be not upper limits, but like actual measurements. But it's
okay,
basically
so it's
in the zero.
Mm-hmm.
It's but okay. Five magnitudes.
Okay, I see.
Increased.
I see,
I mean, it's 10 increase in five magnitudes. So it's basically nothing.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Well, this, by the way, there's a paper in 2020 that it's still disappeared. But basically, it's called like still no star, which I really like. So another option is a melt supernova. In that case, after the star finishes all of its fuel, what's going to happen is that first the core is going to collapse into an iron core. And well, the iron core is going to collapse and it's going to become a protoneutron star. This protoneutron star is going to emit a lot of neutrinos after becoming either a stable neutron star or a black hole. Now, since neutrinos don't interact with matter, they will leave the star, well, almost don't interact with matter, they will leave the star and carry gravitational energy away. And the gravitational energy that they're going to carry is around 0.2 to 0.5 solar masses, which is around 10% of the mass of the outer layers of the star. So it is significant. So this means that that energy could unbind the already loosely bound hydrogen envelope. So this hydrogen envelope is going to expand and cool. And as it expands and cool, there's going to be recombination from the nucleus to hydrogen, and that energy is going to be released in a weak transient that can last for about a year. It is still a weak transient, so this could have been the case. And the nice thing about this scenario is that the ejected envelope can also naturally explain the dust found in N6946 VH1. So this is actually consistent with the scenario. There's another possibility, and this is the one that I'll explore a lot, and this is just a collapse to a black hole. So in that case, imagine that we have the iron core. So this is the core that is already ready to collapse. The fuel has already ended, the star is going to die. So what's going to happen? First, let's think about the stars and divide it in shells. Each shell is individually going to collapse. So the first shell is going to collapse like so. And then later the other one is going to also collapse after. So what's going to happen is that first you're going to form a black hole or a protoneutron star, but in this case, let's say that it's a black hole. And then the next shell is going to collapse and be accreted onto the black hole. But the question is, what's going to happen as more material gets accreted onto the black hole? So if the material has no angular momentum, everything is spherically symmetric, then the material is just going to be accreted onto the black hole. Since the black hole has no surface, any dissipated energy is going to be advected onto the black hole and there's not going to be feedback. Basically, the black hole just grows in mass and nothing super interesting happens, or there is no bright transit. So if there is no angular momentum, the star could just collapse and we wouldn't see anything. On the other hand, if there is high angular momentum, there's going to be a disk form. So material is going to orbit around the black hole and form a disk. There's going to be magnetic torques that draw material from the disk onto the black hole. And that loss in potential energy is going to be dissipated away and there's going to be feedback. In fact, these are some general relativistic magnetohydrodynamical simulations of how material is going to be accreted onto the black hole. This magnetic torques will draw the material. And here I'm also plotting the efficiency. So this is just a cut in different directions. So what I want you to notice here is that the efficiency at some point is going to be very high. And this point is when the magnetic flux balances the heavy inflow, and there's going to be very high energetic feedback from the black hole. So this feedback energy has a lot of energy. So let's recapitulate. First, the first shell is going to collapse. It's going to form a black hole. Now, depending on the angular momentum, the next shell can either form or don't form a disk. Now, if that energy is efficiently converted, if that feedback energy is efficiently converted and the black hole has a lot of feedback, the binding energy of the black hole is much, 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 much larger than the entire binding energy of the star, which means that if little mass is accreted from the accretion disk, and that energy is efficiently converted into feedback, the envelope will entirely be ejected. If the envelope is ejected, there's going to be a bright transient, and we're going to observe it. On the other case, if there is no disk or feedback is really inefficient, then everything is just going to be directly accreted onto the black hole. The envelope won't be ejected. And if that is the case, then we won't be able to see anything. So that could be an explanation for these disappearing stars, that the star just basically collapsed entirely and we didn't see anything. So let's think about what happens for this feedback to be efficient. So here I'm going to show some work done by my collaborators, Aldo Bata and Enrico. And I'll explain what happens as material gets accreted onto the black hole. So again, here we have the star that's ready to collapse. This is the helium core. And we're going to assume that we already have a black hole. We're going to divide the material up in shells. And each shell is going to be accreted onto the black hole. Then the next shell is going to be accreted onto the black hole, et cetera, et cetera. So initially, the black hole is going to have a certain angular momentum, a certain mass, and a certain, which means a certain speed. And in here, I'll just take a moment and say that a very important quantity when regarding black holes is called the innermost stable circular orbit, or ISCO, which is determined by the black hole mass and the black hole spin. And as this name suggests, the ISCO is below it, there are no stable orbits. Above it, there are stable orbits. So everything inside the ISCO is going to be doomed to be swallowed by the black hole. And again, this ISCO depends on the mass and the spin, which means that once the first shell is accreted, that shell is going to add mass to the black hole, and it's going to add angular momentum onto the black hole, which is going to change its ISCO. And then the next shell, as it accretes, it's going to also change the ISCO, et cetera, et cetera. So this is exactly what Aldo and Enrico did. They said, okay, let's divide everything in shells and let's think about how each shell is going to affect the angular momentum and the mass of this of the black hole. So in here, they divide the shell in two parts. So there's going to, since the star is rotating in one direction, there's going to be an angular momentum distribution. And it's going to go as r squared sine squared of theta, because in this case, r squared sine of theta is the lever arm. So this is just a normal angular momentum distribution of each shell. Now, the black hole can't accrete material directly that has high angular momentum, because as we argued before, you're going to have this disk and you're going to need magnetic torques to draw the material from the disk onto the black hole. So we can divide this shell in two parts. We can divide this shell in the part that has very low angular momentum, lower than the angular momentum at the ISCO. And that shell is just going to be directly accreted onto the black hole. Whereas this shell right here that has high angular momentum, higher than the angular momentum at the ISCO, that shell is going to form a disk that can later be accreted, but it's not going to be efficiently accreted onto the black hole as this one that's going to just be directly accreted. But what Aldo and Enrico did is that they divided into shells, and these two shells eventually get accreted onto the black hole, and they contribute differently to the mass and the angular momentum. So I'm sorry for all the formulas, but I won't go into a lot of detail. I'll just say that the shell that has little angular momentum is going to contribute a certain mass and a certain angular momentum to the black hole, whereas the other shell is going to contribute a different angular momentum and a different mass. But in the very end, we're going to have that each shell will contribute a certain angular momentum and a certain mass. and the black hole is going to increase accordingly. So everything is going to be self-consistent. And the black hole, again, is going to increase its angular momentum and its mass as its shell gets accreted. And this is what they did. And what I'm showing here are the results. So I'm going to show an example of how we can apply this formalism in order to explain what happens when the envelope gets ejected. So what I'm plotting here is the mass coordinate of a star. This is for a helium core. And this is the angular momentum of each shell compared to the angular momentum at the east coast. Here, one means the angular momentum at the east coast. So if you're above this line, you can form a disk. So the first thing that comes up, that pops up immediately, is that very low mass stars, so say like 30 solar mass stars, have very little angular momentum, and they're not enough to form a disk. Whereas very high mass stars have extremely high angular momentum, and even when the very first shell, which is like this shell, gets accreted, it's going to have enough angular momentum to form a disk. Whereas there are these intermediate cases where you can either form a disk only at very high mass shells.
So, sorry, can I ask a question? I think sure. I'm got distracted maybe. How do you know what is the angular momentum distribution in the stars as a function of their mass?
That's a fantastic question. So here, these are helium cores from Heger and Woosley. Mm-hmm. And these are cores formed with Kepler. So these are all numerical simulations from the cores that are already ready to collapse.
Yeah,
and you assume, so this is assuming uniform rotation.
Yeah, but I mean, of course, different stars rotate with different rates. So I mean, I don't think there's a law that tells you how fast the star should rotate. So I guess, is there some sort of an empirical assumption there for how fast, the cores rotate?
These stars are rotating at breakup, basically. So the angular momentum here is the angular momentum at breakup.
Oh, you assume it's breakup. Okay.
Yes.
This is a maximum angular momentum then.
Yes.
Okay. I see.
Sorry. I should have clarified. So this is all assuming that this is a uniform rotation and that the star is rotating. I think it's actually at a certain fraction of the breakup.
Oh, okay.
Or rather, the maximum angular momentum is a fraction of the angular momentum at the breakup. But these are all assumptions that need to be made.
Okay, I see, thanks.
You're welcome. And with this formalism, what's very interesting that we can do is we can say when the star is going to eject its envelope. So here what I'm plotting is the energy as a function of mass coordinate. This is for a 30 solar mass star taken from the other example. And I'm going to show you at what point does this formalism say that the envelope is going to be ejected. So this dashed line right here shows the binding energy of the star. And this line right here shows the binding energy of the star, but with the correction of the fact that since everything is collapsing, there's going to be an extra kinetic energy term. So this is just adding this extra kinetic energy. So this is like the real binding energy of the star, let's say. These two lines right here represent the energy from the shell. So each time the shell gets accreted, it's going to have a certain feedback energy taken from the GRMHT simulations with the efficiency of the GRMHT simulations. And these two lines represent different recipes to consider the feedback. So this is the very pessimistic case where you have feedback with losses, which means that if the shell gets accreted, it's not going to that shell, and the shell does not form a disk, it's not going to contribute. So only the shell that actually forms the disk is going to contribute to the feedback. So that's like the most pessimistic case, whereas this case is the case where the energy is cumulative. So each time the shell gets accreted, it accumulates the energy and accumulates the energy. So it's the most optimistic case. So, and these two points, of course, represent when these two lines crosses. And these two points are when the binding energy of the feedback is equal to the binding energy of the star, which means that the feedback energy is going to eject the envelope. So somewhere around these two lines is the actual like real place where the envelope could be ejected. And what I want you to notice is that even in the most pessimistic case, you eject the star at around 70%, you eject around 30% of the mass of the star, which means that the final black hole is around 70% of the original mass. So it is pretty significant. And if you consider the spin, it's even more significant. So for example, again, this is the third, so the 30 solar mass star, the 34.
May I ask you a question?
Sure.
So when you, let's say you do have a disk, and then you want to calculate how much energy, feedback energy you get out from this disk equation. Did you incorporate this disk outflows as a function of, let's say, radius or something like that?
So this is just considering the efficiency. This efficiency. So it is mainly as a function of time and as a function of, well, it's the mass of the disk and everything. So actually, like McKinney has this really nice table in which Aldo took all the efficiencies and interpolated the efficiency.
Right. So I think this does not include, I mean, probably a large fraction of the mass probably is already ejected out before reaching the vicinity of the black hole, right? So the
Yeah, so this is assuming that the star is going to remain as it is, like each shell gets accreted and each shell has the same property as it had before the collapse, which of course is not necessarily true. It's just an approximation. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, okay. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Sorry, can I also just follow up on this? So one critical assumption is also like the velocity with which you expect these outflows to occur from the disk, because that is essentially setting the energetic, so the kinetic energy of the feedback, and so those have to come also from either like simulations or you know some other assumptions you make. So what is it that you're assuming there?
So for the velocities, I don't think they're assuming anything other than the efficiency. So I think that Aldo only took the efficiency from those papers. Basically, this is a very simple model, a simpler model. And again, like the each shell is going to be exactly as it was before.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is all very simple. More simulations could be very interesting and more calculations, but this is just to prove that the main reason for this is to prove that it is very important to consider all these kinds of collapses. And again, this is a very first approximation. And so what's really interesting again is that we can also obtain the black hole of the spin the same way that we obtained the final mass of the black hole. Sorry, the final spin of the black hole. So again, this is a plot of the final spin of the black hole. This is as a function of the mass coordinate. And what's really interesting is that, again, this is when efficient feedback happens. So this is like the most optimistic scenario. And this is the least optimistic scenario. This is very inefficient feedback. And basically somewhere around this line is where the final spin of the black hole is going to be according to this formalism. So as you can see, it can be pretty different from if it were absolutely no feedback. So this is, if there were no disks and everything, this would be the final spin of the black hole. And as you can see, it can get pretty different. So like 0.8, so like 0.6 versus 0.8. So this is something very important to consider. Now, hopefully I have convinced you that by this point, if we have very high angular momentum at disk forms, that can halt the collapse of the star, and there's not going to be a bright transient if everything is just, oh sorry, at no angular momentum, everything just directly collapses into the black hole, there is no bright transient. But if we have very high angular momentum, there is a disk that will eject the envelope and there's going to be a bright transient. But what happens in the middle? What is the largest rotation? So the question that we want to answer is, what is the largest rotation rate a star can have before forming an efficient disk? Is it possible to have a disk when the angular momentum is less than the angular momentum at disco? And more importantly, is this formation enough to guarantee an efficient feedback? So those are the questions that I want to answer, and those are the questions that I'll talk about in more detail. So in order to do that, we need to understand low angular momentum flows. So what's going to happen around the angular momentum at the disk? And let me show you how particles get into the black hole. So at the trajectory. So these are the trajectories of particles when they enter a black hole. You can have particles that have this trajectory A, which are the no angular momentum trajectories, and those just get directly accreted onto the black hole. We can have trajectories like C, where there's high angular momentum and you form a disk. So those are all interesting, but the most interesting one are particles with trajectory B. So in that case, those are particles that would be accreted onto the black hole, but they cross the equator at some point. So they do something like these kinds of trajectories. Now, the thing is that if you have a particle coming in this way, you're going to have a particle coming in from the other hemisphere. So it's going to do kind of like this. They're going to encounter in the equator. There's going to be then, they're going to collide. There's going to be the cancellation of the vertical momentum. And they're going to dissipate energy away before rotating a little bit the black hole, and they're going to form a very thin disk. So this is called a mini disk, and this is what I've been working on. And yeah, so basically you need to study them numerically. You need to numerically study this dissipation. And this is what I did. So what we did was I used HARM, which is, it's called High Accuracy Relativistic Magnetohydrodynamics. And it's a code that solves the conservation equations of general relativistic magnetohydrodynamics. We're going to assume a polytropic equation of state and no magnetic fields, and just shameless self-promotion here for Dan, that the paper with neutrinos and tabulated EOSs in HARM is almost ready. So please ask me about this if you want. So for our simulation setup, we're going to have this helium core that's already ready to collapse. And we're going to focus on these very inner regions, very, very near the black hole. Everything is going to be collapsing and there's going to be a certain inflow. And from here on, I'm going to work in geometrical units where g equals equals one. And all of our scales are going to be given by the gravitational radii, which is half of the Schwarzschild radii. So of course, the most important quantity of this problem is the angular momentum, because this is what we're going to vary. We're going to study the low angular momentum flows. So we're going to assume that the angular momentum is constant as a function of radius. And we're going to set the angular momentum as a fraction of the angular momentum at the ISCO times an angular function. This is just so that we can smoothly disappear at the boundary. So this is just for numerical reasons. But the key parameter is going to be what I'll call the slowdown parameter, or C. And this is just a fraction of the angular momentum of the ISCO. And from here on, I'm going to show you these kinds of plots. And these plots are basically, we're going to focus on half of the hemisphere right here. So this is how the angular momentum looks like at the very first snapshot of the simulation. So let me show you the results. Let's see what happens when we vary the angular momentum. So here I'm showing two plots of the energy at the same time, but with different slowdown factors. The cyan line represents the radius of the ISCO, which again is the innermost stable circular orbit. And anything inside the ISCO is going to be just doomed to fall into the black hole. So we're not interested in what happens inside the ISCO, just outside of it, because outside of it, the matter is going to be able to produce a feedback. And also the magenta lines right here just represents the velocity vectors. So this is for C equals zero. So this is no angular momentum or the spherically symmetric case. And here I'm going to start with 70% of the angular momentum at the ISCO. So as you can see from here immediately is that there is accumulation of matter or energy at the equator. This is not surprising at all because as we discussed before, there's going to be particles that are going to fall around here, and there's going to be particles that do this trajectory, they're going to encounter, they're going to dissipate energy, and they're going to stay in there for a bit. So there's going to be an accumulation of matter here. But still, there's nothing super interesting happening. And one thing that I should clarify is that our domain is, so we chose our domain to be 200 RG, and our domain is always supersonic. Just that'll be important later. Now let's increase the angular momentum to like 90% of the angular momentum at disk. So things are starting to get a little bit more interesting. There's going to be accumulation of matter here, but again, the thing is that the energy accumulation is going to entirely be advected onto the black hole. Because since everything is supersonic, there's no way in which we can communicate that energy dissipation outwards, and everything, any energy that could have been dissipated is just going to be advected onto the black hole. So that case is, although interesting, it's still not dissipative. But what happens then at 1.1, the angular momentum to East Coast? So here, the energy dissipation rate is beginning to win over the advection rate, and you're going to start to see this very hot bubble that is going to form. So this is like this, a pressure bubble. But in this case, it's still inside the ISCO. So there will be no energy dissipation because you can communicate outside. But we're starting to get even more interesting. But what happens if we go even higher? Then we have a fully formed bubble. So this shock right here, which is a real shock, is already outside the ISCO. And this very high pressure buildup is going to slow down the material and have this angular momentum redistribution shock. And what happens if we go into even higher angular momentum? So the bubble is of course growing. And I don't know if you can see, but in this case, it's actually pointing radially outwards. So this shock is basically just plowing through the material and it's going to expand. Now, what I'm showing here is this shock. And here I'm plotting the ramp pressure of the shock. So this is just rho v squared. This purple line right here represents the position of the shock. So this is this case right here, and this is just the density of the shock. And what I want you to notice is that this shock carries a lot of ramp pressure. So as this shock expands, it's going to, it has the ramp pressure to unbind the envelope of the star. So it could potentially unbind the incoming material. In fact, this whole ramp pressure material will be expanding. And if it continues like that through the entire star, it will unbind it. And what I'm showing here is the position of the shock as a function of time. This is for three different slowdown factors where we actually have a shock, well, a bubble or a shock.
Sorry, can I ask?
Yep.
So I'm just trying to see which part of the material is going inward and which part of the material is going outward. Is it easy to tell from that figure?
So from here, sorry about my dog, by the way. So from here, this material right here is expanding, and all of this material outside is going inward.
So which part of the material is actually going into the black hole? So basically,
that's a great question. So let me just talk a little bit about the mass accretion rate and then return. So we can actually have the mass, we can actually calculate the mass accretion rate for different slowdown factors. This is the mass accretion rate compared to the Bondi case, which is the C equals no angular momentum case or C equals zero case. This is in the polar region and this is in the equatorial region. But what I mean with polar region is this region is the polar region and this is the equatorial region. So all of this material, for example, is going to be accreted onto the black hole. Because the shock, I mean, even though the shock is expanding, it's expanding mainly in the equatorial region, not so much in the polar region. So in here, in the equator, we're going to have that the mass accretion rate is really, really, it's much lower than the angular, than the mass accretion rate at the Bondi cases. Whereas, for example, in the cases where we don't form a bubble or a shock, since you have accumulation of density in the equator, the mass accretion rate is actually going to increase. Whereas in the polar region, once you form the bubble, the shock is, so in the polar region, since there's not a lot of accumulation of density, the mass accretion rate is decreased compared to the Bondi case. But yeah, basically you do get material from around here. And you do get some material from these parts right here. So in this region, it's basically outwards, but you do still see this redistribution and material from around here is going to be accreted too. But in any case, this shock will have the energy and the ramp pressure to unbind the entire star if needed. So what I'm showing right here again is the position of the shock as a function of time, as a function, and these are for three different slowdown factors. And what I want you to notice right away is that the velocity is constant. And we can calculate the velocity, well, it's almost constant. And we can calculate the velocity of the shock. This is, by the way, in the equator. So this is the velocity right here. And we can calculate the velocity. And here I'm just showing the three different velocities that we calculated. And at the edge of our domain, the velocity is like 0.07c. And you can take this velocity to be kind of like an escape velocity. So what you can see is that in these two cases, at least for a slowdown factor, that's twice the angular momentum of the ISCO and 1.5 the angular momentum of the ISCO. You do get that the velocity of the shock is higher than the escape velocity, which means that once it reaches the edge of the domain, if it continues traversing through the star like that, the envelope is going to be ejected. And there's going to be a bright transfer. Now, what happens if a bubble is not formed? So here, what I'm showing is it's the energy for two different slowdown factors. This is for a slowdown factor of 0.9 or 90% of the angular momentum of the ISCO. And this is for 1.2. And these are for two different times. So this is 200, well, this is 200 in our units. And this is basically 300 in our units. And what I wanted to notice is that if you form a bubble, the bubble expands and it could unbind the envelope. Whereas if there is no bubble, everything is just like, it's very steady. It's not going to change the structure. So, but if you have this rotationally supported structure, then you can potentially unbind the star. Now, of course, what we want to know is when we form a bubble and when we don't, when there is efficient feedback and when the feedback is efficient. So here what I'm showing is a way in which to differentiate. So here I'm plotting the integrated energy compared to the integrated energy of Bondi inside a certain radius. So this is, for example, these stars are the energy inside the ISCO compared to the energy inside the ISCO of the no angular momentum case as a function of the slowdown parameter. And you can clearly see that there is a transition around the slowdown factor of 1.2, which means that above this one, you get the bubble. You get this rotationally supported structure that can have energy dissipation due to image distresses and could potentially unbind the envelope. So basically what I'm saying is that above C of 1.2, there is efficient feedback, whereas below 1.2, there is not efficient feedback, even if you form a disk. So basically, let's return to what the point was. So we were trying to calculate the maximum angular momentum of disappearing stars. And now we know that a slowdown factor of 1.2, there is a transition between efficient and not efficient feedback. And we can use this in order to constrain the maximum angular momentum of the disappearing stars. Because we know that for a disappearing star, we need efficient feedback at all times from all the shells of all the star. So basically, as each shell accretes, that shell needs to have an angular momentum that's lower than 1.2 times the angular momentum at the ISCO. Notice, of course, that this quantity is going to change as each shell gets accreted. But since we have the formalism, we know how this quantity is going to evolve. So we can then try to get when the angular momentum of all the shells is going to be smaller than the angular moment than 1.2 times the angular momentum at the ISCO. So let me recapitulate and talk a little bit more about these two disappearing stars, just as a reminder. So we had two disappearing stars, N6946BH1, which is the like 20 to 30 solar mass star, And we had this luminous blue variable, which was this monster of like 100 solar masses up. And here what I'm showing is the position in the HR diagram. So this is the luminosity versus the temperature. And what I'm overplotting right here are some MESA models. So MESA is a stellar structure code that we can use in order to evolve stars and see what their final structure is going to be like numerically and with, of course, with caveats and everything, but we can use this. So here I'm showing, this is for a metallicity that's similar to the sun's metallicity. And this is for a very low metallicity environment because this star is in a very low metallicity environment. And these are just different MESA models. And this is just so that we can actually use these models to know what the masses is, know what the mass of the star should be. So we estimated the mass to be around 23 to 28 solar masses for this one. And this star, we estimated the mass to be 98 up, basically. What's really nice about these MESA models is that we can know the internal structure of the star. So we can know the density, which means that we can know the moment of inertia, for example, which means that we have everything that we need in order to calculate the angular momentum and the maximum angular momentum. So what I'm plotting right here is the maximum allowed angular velocity for the R2 progenitors. So this is the angular velocity compared to the angular velocity at the breakup. And this is the initial mass. So what we did is we took different initial masses. We got their internal structure for MESA for different metallicities. And we said, okay, when is this condition true? So when is the angular momentum lower than 1.2, the angular momentum at the east? Because if it is lower, we know that there's going to be inefficient feedback, which means that there's not going to be a bright transient. So in this Hatch region right here, this condition is true, which means that in the Hatch region, there's not going to be a bright transient. Whereas in here, if the star has this angular momentum or this angular velocity, the envelope will be ejected and we will see something. And this is just overplotted with N6946BH1 and PHL293B. So with this, we can constrain their final angular velocity, which is really nice. So this means that, for example, this star has to have a smaller angular momentum than like 10 to the minus 3 of its breakup velocity. And we can go a step even further because there's this really nice catalog of very massive stars and the rotation rate. So this is observational data from the BLT for the tarantula survey in 30 Dorados. We know the several masses of stars and we know the rotation rates. So here, these light blue dots are actual observational data and of non-evolved stars, but we can use this very simple relation, which is just evolving the moment of inertia and the angular momentum. We can evolve that and we can say, what is the angular velocity, the final angular velocity of the star or of the star when it's going to be ready to die, to collapse. So these are all the blue dots right here are just these light blue dots, but evolved. And again, this line right here is the same as these lines right here. This is where this condition is true. So in this Hatch region, there's not going to be a bright transient. Whereas in this case, you are going to have a bright transient, which of course means that the majority of the stars are going to end up in bright transient, which is not surprising. But what we can do is we can count how many stars we predict could end up having a bright and not having a bright transient or just disappearing without a trace. And we estimate that around 5% of the stars should end up disappearing without a bright transient. And this is very similar to the observational limit that they got by observing one disappearing star, which is around 7%. Now, let me just say this, that this number is extremely dependent on the MESA models used. If we change, for example, the wind prescription by a bit, because these are all very massive stars, so the prescription could be very different. the fraction actually becomes like 7% if we change the wind by a little bit. So take this at the, so even though we can use this formalism in order to get the fraction, this fraction could be a little bit different. So for our conclusions, the direct collapse of to a black hole of a very slowly rotating massive star can result in that star just disappears without a bright trans. And we can use numerical simulations in order to constrain the maximum angular momentum of such stars. And we also predict that the fraction of massive stars that disappear without a bright transient is around 5%. And I'll just leave you with this slide that you can also ask me about all these kinds of interesting things. And thank you very much. And thank you very much for inviting me and for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Arianna. Do we have questions?
So maybe, so in your harm simulation, how did you describe the dissipation? Do you have, let's say, like the some kind of alpha type of dissipation, like there's a dissipative viscous torque, or how do you set up the dissipation in your simulation?
That's a very good question. So we struggle a lot trying to get the energy dissipation or some kind of efficiency. It's really hard in those cases because, so we have no magnetic fields. So we don't expect magnetic torques to draw material in. And I mean, we know that all of the dissipation is numerical in our case, again, because we don't have magnetic fields. So one of the things that I want to do is add magnetic fields actually to this. But we didn't calculate the efficiency. So what we did was we mainly took the different slowdown factors and tried to understand when we had the bubble and when we didn't. So that is like that line that you saw, it's when we have the bubble, because if you don't have a bubble, since the domain is supersonic, there's not going to be communication to the outer regions. And we know that even if energy were dissipated, it would just be directly advected onto the black hole because it cannot communicate to the outer regions. Yeah, we had a long discussion about this.
Okay, so you're basically saying there is no, so in your evolution, there is no like viscous dissipation or magnetic related dissipation. Okay.
Not that we can calculate from this one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so the simulations are 2D or are they three-dimensional? I guess axisymmetric?
2D. 2D, yes.
2D, okay, good. And so there's as Juan said, there's no alpha term or anything included in there.
No.
Okay. Because I have to think a little more about it, but I'm still a little confused as how you actually get this feedback shock in that case. So you essentially only
from the collisions.
Okay. Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, right. This is only from the collisions, basically.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Any more questions? Will has a question, I see.
So I was wondering what was sort of the best case sort of observational signature that would allow you to distinguish this model of a black hole forming and the collapse of a massive star from other models for these disappearing stars?
That's a very good question. I don't know if, I guess, like, for example, in the mild supernova case, I guess you could try to get the mild supernova, like you could try to get it. I don't know if you can differentiate because everything, I mean, if it disappears, I guess you could try to look after for something, see if there's a neutron star or something. But I mean, for these massive stars, you should end up in a black hole. I don't know. I guess for the mild luminosity, it's only a matter of like catching the mild luminosity case, that supernova, the mild luminosity supernova.
Okay, so I have a question. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm willing to believe that it's a safe conclusion to say that if the angular momentum is sufficiently high, that you'll have a bright transient. But when you say if it's too low, you won't have one, there's more caveats to that, right? Because, yeah. For example, we don't know what happens to the turbulence in the star as it collapses.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's this really nice paper by Yellow-Quattard in which they calculate the, so there's convective motions in the outer layers that just due to random motions, you can have a disk. So you can form a disk just by random motions, and that disk could potentially produce feedback and eject the star. Yeah, so yes, I mean, there are, yeah.
In that paper, they don't show the what happens to this random angular momentum as the star collapses. They just find that in the convection zone, you know, if you were to just teleport that material down to the ISCO, it wouldn't accrete. So yeah, there's still an open question there.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are of course tons of caveats. Again, this is assuming that the shells behave really nicely, that they just collapse as they are and that nothing else happens in the outer regions of the star, which is of course not true.
So I was wondering, do you have predictions for gravitational wave emission from this or not?
No, so HARM does not have numerical relativity, so you couldn't do that as it is, but it could be interesting. I mean, I guess you could try to do something with that. That could be interesting, but not with the simulations.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Drew has a question.
Yeah, related to the previous comment, I think you were saying with this regular
random motions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, random motions. I think so in the previous, or in one of the middle slides, you said that if the angular momentum is less than the ISCO, could you still form a disk? So that, is that related? Like, is that how it could possibly, how a disk could possibly form, even though you didn't see that in your simulations?
Yeah, so in that case, you could potentially like have some feedback and maybe like even some kind of like accretion type of disk.
Okay, but you didn't find that in your simulations, I guess, because...
Yeah, no, but we weren't simulating random motion. Like the density behaves nicely also.
I see.
Okay, Will, do you have another question? I still see a raised hand, or is that just the one from before?
No.
Okay, great. Any other questions for Ariana?
I have a quick one.
Thoughts?
So hi.
Hi.
Yeah. Thanks for the great talk. You mentioned that the models you were investigating assumed sort of well-behaved shells, particularly in the outer part of the star. Do you have any intuition for what the presence of a companion would do to
that? I mean, that's a fantastic question. I mean, it's going to create tons and tons of chaos. And it's going to also change the angular momentum. So like this of course is just assuming a single isolated star for sure. No, for sure that's going to change the results a lot.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
I actually remember, so on that note, I actually remember, I think, was it you or you did some SPH simulations, I think in the past, showing like in a binary star where there's sort of one explosion. So if you have say, an explosive phenomenon on one massive star, for example, you can actually capture some of that material on the companion star or so. I don't exactly recall if that was your simulations or someone else's from your group.
I think it was Sophie, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I haven't dabbled into SPH, but I want to.
Yeah, there's certainly some very interesting phenomena then once you start doing this with binaries, stellar binaries.
Sure, for sure.
Okay, any final questions? If not, so Ariana and I will certainly stay here on the call for another 10 or 20 minutes. If people want to chat a little more informally or start some other discussion, we'll be here. If there are no further questions, then let's thank Ariana again for a great talk and see you all next week.